When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Welcome to another episode of the Dose of Leadership podcast, the show that brings you inspiring and educational interviews with today's most relevant and motivating leaders. Each episode is dedicated to highlight real-life leadership and influence experts who dedicate their lives to the pursuit of the truth, common sense, and courageous leadership. And now, here's your host, Richard Ryerson.
Hey, welcome to the show. Thanks for tuning in to Dose of Leadership. We have a special Equity Bank-sponsored podcast episode here. On the show today is Sandy Kemper. He is the founder and CEO of a company called C2FO. And I was really intrigued by this business, and you'll hear me, I kind of geek out in this show, because it's a business concept that I hadn't even thought about, I didn't even know existed, and when you hear it, at least for me, it like really clicked. I'm a big guy, I geek out when it comes to efficiencies and kind of making things simpler, understanding that simple things aren't easy. And this is a concept that C2FO really resonated with me because it you can trace the roots of this company back to banking and understanding the limitation or recognizing the limitations that financial institutions have of creating this kind of transparent view of working capital, particularly for small companies. And so the underwriting of credit is inefficient and costly. And so what Sandy Kemper and has come up with is instead of using the traditional financial intermediaries, whether they're banks or lenders, what is missing is this visibility of both the accounts receivable and the accounts payable equation. And so to solve that problem, what C2FO does is like, look, we want to make a seamless match between accounts receivable and accounts payable. And so in other words, it allows suppliers to take control of their cash flow, you know, enable this kind of riskless idea of working capital between suppliers and buyers. In other words, instead of, you know, on the accounts receivable side, I get paid faster. So I don't have to, you know, wait 60 days, you know, to get paid. I can get paid a lot quicker and my cash flow, which is king, I take more control over. And buyers eventually increase their EBITDA and their gross margin and earn a better return on that short-term cash, which improves the financial health of the supply chains. I know that's geeky, and I didn't consider myself a financial guy. I guess I'm a little more passionate about it than I originally thought, but the idea that you can make there's a solution instead of borrowing money to increase cash flow because of my payment terms and the accounts payable, I get a bigger return on my investment. I can get discounts on what I pay. It's a win-win for everybody. And just, I don't know, you'll have to listen to the show. And if you want to geek out a little bit and find something that unique, I think it's a unique solution with a dynamic leader. Sandy Kemper is one of the good ones. And he's a dynamic leader, shares all the traits that we talk about intensely here on Dose of Leadership, and it was just a really great conversation. I think he's the right leader for the right time in a unique situation in a unique world, and he's even got a white paper, and I'll attach that white paper to the show notes on doseofleadership.com if you want to go there and find it. But it's essentially it's a white paper, an idea, particularly in this COVID-19 crisis, of how to solve this kind of $16 trillion small business liquidity trap that we find ourselves in. And it's not borrowing. It's creating a low-cost funding specifically for larger companies so that they can pay their small and mid-sized suppliers immediately. And what it all boils down to is essentially job creation. And we'll get into the details in the conversation here, and I'll let Sandy explain it better than I can. But I think stick with this conversation. It's a unique one with a very dynamic and very unique leader in Sandy Kemper. And I think it's a special conversation. It's a unique, it's a different one. But if you're concerned about business, if you're concerned about accounts receivable, accounts payable, and how leadership fits into all that, listen to the show. This is a perfect one, and I'm really proud of this episode, and I'm glad you're tuning in. It is brought to you by my friends at Equity Bank. Equity Bank, it is a team that knows what it takes to start and grow a business. It's been exciting to watch Equity Bank grow into one of the fastest-growing banks in the Midwest. They're now listed on the NASDAQ exchange. They've got locations all across Kansas, as well as Oklahoma, Missouri, and Arkansas. And clearly, this team at Equity Bank knows how to lead for growth. And so if it feels like your current bank is more of a follower than a leader, and you want to work with a bank that really understands your needs, go check out Equity Bank. EquityBank.com is where you can find all the details. Hey, thanks for listening. Now let's join our conversation with Sandy Kemper, the CEO of C2FO, here on Dose of Leadership. Sandy, what a thrill to have you on Dose of Leadership. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
I was really looking forward to this conversation because obviously with your family background up in Kansas City and you're close, and there's so much that I did not know about this industry you're in. And it just, I started reading about what you do and how you do it. And pardon my naivete about it, but I'm like, why didn't somebody think about this before? I mean, it seems like when you lay the business model out, it makes perfect common sense. And why no one has done it before? What is your answer to that?
Well, maybe we just got lucky. You're nice to say that. It is pretty much self-evident, right? The idea of what we do is we help businesses get paid sooner by those who owe them money.
Right.
And that's, you know, as an old banker still on the board of our bank and have deep respect for what the banking system can do and does to really drive our economy, there still is a fundamental flaw in the thinking of underwriting an account receivable. So if I'm a supplier, a small business, if you will, and I'm selling to a big business or any business for that matter, I'm going to receive payment later. In the business-to-business world, payment comes in 30 days or 60 days or 90 days.
Right.
And various different terms and tranches exist. So I was going to be an account receivable in my books. To the big business or otherwise my customer, that's an account payable. Banks look at one part of the equation, the account receivable, and they underwrite for that account receivable. In other words, they look at the owner of that account receivable and they say, do I want to loan money to that company? Not a bad structure, but really it's a backward structure.
Yeah.
Instead, we should be looking at the strength of the payer and whether that payment's going to be made. And the way you get to that account payable, at least we thought and think, and hopefully it's still working, is to cause large buyers and others to load their accounts payable into a marketplace like ours and show when that payment's going to be made, allowing the owner of the account receivable then in the marketplace to request payment early by offering a small discount, less than what that supplier might be paying to their bank, as an example, a small discount directly to the buyer, their customer, to induce that customer to pay them sooner. So we get payment, capital, cash flow to businesses faster at the price that they want and at a price that they name.
Yeah, it's a win-win for everybody. I mean, I remember sitting there when I was telling you I got furloughed from American Airlines and thrust in the business world, you know, 18 years ago. And I remember I had some great mentors and from his vantage point, he was talking about, man, cash, you know, he's telling cash flow is king. And it's like, we got to hang on to these payables for, you know, we got 60-day terms or whatever the terms were, you know, because he's trying to make that money work for him. And so what you're saying, like I said, it's backwards, it's upside down. Or it's backwards anyway, and you can say, okay, I'm going to look at the payable guy, so he can maximize his use of cash. And so if he can get a discount for paying early, that's making his right money work for him better.
Look, and if that entity, that customer, that buyer has extra cash on balance sheet, where is it? Oh, it might be in a money market fund, it might be in a bank, it might be in a CD, it might be in some other various saving instrument. Well, those things don't pay very well.
Right.
On the other hand, that supplier who needs that capital, needs that cash, if they don't have excess cash, they're having to borrow.
Right.
And so we've got this sort of odd structure where many corporations are in effect borrowing from their supply chain, even though they might have cash on balance sheet at bank making 10 basis points, their suppliers are borrowing at 6%. And that's the structure that doesn't make a lot of sense to us. So why not settle somewhere between my 10 basis points I'm making on my cash and the 600 basis points or 6% that I'm causing my supply chain to borrow and clear at 3 or 4%? You, the customer, the buyer in this case, making more than your 10 basis points, and your supplier paying less in cost than what they're paying to borrow.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And then everybody's getting...
It's not terribly brilliant. It's actually pretty easy. There's no brilliance to it. It's just you ask the question, why hasn't it been done? And it is a question that I have asked for the last decade. And there are a few companies around the world that are replicating what we're doing. But I think the answer is folks that know finance, entrepreneurs that understand finance, generally aren't technology folks.
Yeah.
Technology folks and entrepreneurs who are technologists kind of don't understand finance. And I've been lucky to be ex of a bank and I understand tech a little bit. I've got a great team. So it was just a sweet spot opportunity for weird creatures like me and our team to be able to achieve.
Well, there still has to be some, I'm imagining there has to be some proprietary software in there. If I'm on the payable side, if I understand this correctly, it's like I said, I put those in there that I'm willing to pay early. I'm looking for some sort of return, right? Basically is what I'm looking for.
You're going to load. Well, generally what happens, we actually have about 1.3 trillion of accounts payable
right
in the marketplace today. And so companies, it's pretty simple. Companies simply move their entire accounts payable file to us. We in the marketplace then push that on our platform to all of their suppliers. So those suppliers can see what they're owed and when it will be paid. And that's a free service that we offer. And that helps those companies understand the timing of their cash flow receipts. And if they want to accelerate those cash flow receipts, that payment, they can put an offer into the marketplace that works for them to see if their customer will accept that offer and pay them early.
Yeah. I like it. I mean, I know you said to me, it's brilliant. This isn't my area of expertise. I mean, I'm not a financial wizard when it comes to this, but I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. And I love simplicity, right? And it seems simple to me. Simple doesn't mean it's easy to execute, but I mean, obviously you guys have figured it out.
We have $1.5 trillion and hopefully by the end of the year, $2 trillion in the marketplace, but you know, Richard, we're far from figuring it out. But I mean, here's the good news, right? It's a very large market. Generally, in the course of a year, businesses trading with other businesses will buy and sell roughly $240 trillion of goods and services between themselves. So we have a long way to go to get to that $200 trillion-plus mark, and we're striving mightily to get there. But it's... I'm kind of with you. We've had this debate for a while. We'd love to see more marketplaces like ours proliferate because we think it's just generally a better solution for cash flow for companies that need it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't overemphasize. I mean, I love when I see, again, my expertise is kind of operations and cutting through the chaff and making things simple. And when I saw it, it just, you know, it's hard for me to describe, but it just like clicked in my head. I'm like, oh my God, that's so simple. You know, and I love simplicity. I love cleanness. I love,
we're putting into control of the consumer. So imagine you're at the grocery store and you see your half gallon of milk for $2.49. And you're like, yeah, I'd like to pay $1.96.
Right.
And if at that time there was an excess of milk, maybe the grocer would have accepted that $1.96 because otherwise they might have to dump the milk out. So basically what we've done is created a marketplace for demand pricing against supply need, except it's not milk, it's time value of money. So I will be paid this amount of money in 30 days. Gosh, I'd like to get it tomorrow, and here's what I might offer to do it. So when a buyer, a customer of a supplier, pays that supplier early, are they taking credit risk? No, because they know they're going to pay that. They accepted the good that came from that supplier. It's in their AP system. Hey, I'm going to pay you in 45 days. if I pay too early, I know I'm going to pay in 5 days. So I'm not taking credit risk. I'm just taking an earlier payment. So maybe I want a little bit of discount to cause that cash to come to you. Now, let's flip it around and look at the bank. When I was a banker, was I taking credit risk when I was loaning against that account receivable, giving capital to the supplier?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely, I was. And so our whole thesis is there's no need for risk underwriting of working capital when you can match the account receivable with the account payable and create a place where that owner of the AR can give a little discount to cause the payer of the account payable to pay more rapidly.
Yeah, I love it. And I think that time value to money, I maybe you know this. I mean, there has to be some sort of metric or advantage, something, the improvement of what happens to businesses, job creation or something. There has to be a metric where you close that gap. If I'm getting paid in 20 days as opposed to 60, that has to create something. Am I right? Am I thinking in the right way?
And you say you're not a financial expert. Exactly. Yeah. here's that you're right on. In fact, that's the number that we don't publish, but that we think about the most at our company. And that's the amount of new job creation that is enabled by the working capital flows in our market. So we're getting up to, $1 billion a day. We haven't hit it yet. 500 billion, 600 billion, 700 billion a day on good days. And looking at that aggregation over the course of a year, there are studies that have been done by the SBA and the Federal Reserve that look at what early payment means to companies. So as an example, the government put an early payment program together years ago for small and mid-sized businesses. They took payment from 35 days to 5 days or 25 days to 5 days, I forget. And then they calculated, going back and talking to those suppliers, how that early payment was used. And a fair amount of it, I mean, a surprisingly large amount of it, was used on hiring new people.
Mm.
So last year, in 2019, using that formula, our company, C2FO, and the flows that we enabled created approximately 70,000 jobs in the U.S. economy. And this year, we should do 110,000 to 120,000 jobs.
That's incredible. I mean, intuitively, that makes sense, right? I mean, I'm just thinking myself and seeing from my time in the business world that just seeing how cash flow was so important. It's like, if I had this cash now and I wasn't encumbered by debt, what I could do with that cash. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just feels more certain. Banks, as I said, terribly important to the economy and do extraordinary things to help catalyze economic growth. We would argue that it's not the best use of a bank's focus to go after working capital because you can create a better match through AP and AR. That doesn't mean the banks aren't massively needed and aren't massive stimuli to our economy. They are. It's just that I think this particular example shows that a better solution can be had if marketplaces like ours can proliferate.
I love it. It's so exciting to me. I mean, I just think it's really cool. I don't know.
It's 10 years. And as I said, we're still yet to hit our first $1 billion day, which is where our goal was, you know, to hit that this year. Hopefully we will, even with this pandemic being very problematic. But, you know, the interesting thing about it, it still takes a lot of time to cause a big business, and usually our customers on the buyer side are very, very large companies. I think we have 126 of the
Big names. I've seen
Fortune
them,
500 or something like that. They have really big names. So that's a long sales cycle. So you have to be pretty good at enterprise selling. But the thing that's been the most challenging and interesting to me is, and I guess it's because all of the suppliers, just like any of us, right, running businesses, are pretty busy doing our gig. And now we're saying, oh, here's a new thing you need to think about. Yeah, I know it's only two clicks and you get your cash, but it's still, like, who are you? How does this work? Right. What do you mean two clicks to cash? How do you know what my accounts receivable are? There's still a fair amount of education, both on the buy side and the sell side. So you're right. We're lucky to have a very simple model that works pretty well, but it's surprising even in today's world where simplicity should cause faster understanding and faster participation. There's still so much distraction, so much attention focused on all these small businesses, mid-sized businesses they have very harried entrepreneurs, right? Mm-hmm. And that CEO, she's thinking about 100 different things every hour.
Right.
And yet here's a new idea. Maybe you could use this. And he or she says, well, but I don't understand it. How does it work? So there's still an amount of education. So that's why it's great to be on programs like this, where we can talk a little bit about what we do. We don't do a lot of advertising. Most of what we do is word of mouth, suppliers talking to other suppliers.
Yeah.
Thank you for saying it's simple. I wish everyone who had the potential to use it understood it as quickly as you do. There's still a lot of education that needs to take place.
Well, I can imagine. Like you said, and you hit the nail on the head. I mean, you've got a CEO and the time, and I know after working and even trying to sell to CEOs, I mean, you get 5 minutes and you're trying to show the value, and it's like, again, they're thinking of a gazillion different things.
Yep.
Their time is so limited. You're absolutely right. So your organization then, what are you looking for in types of individuals? I mean, when we talk about simplicity, you know, I say the same thing about leadership. Leadership is so easy to understand, but it is so doggone difficult to execute because of...
Leadership is easy to understand in retrospect. It's really hard to do present tense.
In the middle of it.
It's almost impossible to do future tense.
Amen. It's so true.
So our people typically, as I said, we're getting up to almost 500 folks. We have about 1.1 million businesses on our platform. Our folks think about that job creation number.
Yeah.
Our folks think about building a better solution that allows working capital to flow more effectively. Here's the problem. I said there's about $240 trillion of trade between businesses in the course of the year. Well, on 60-day payment terms, that's going to be plus or minus $40 trillion of accounts receivable or accounts payable on the books of businesses around the world on any given day. Now, you're not a financial dude, and most people couldn't figure this out. Anyway, we've done some research on it. In all of the world, there's maybe $3 to $5 trillion of total finance, asset-based lending, factoring, banks, you name it. Maybe $5 trillion of traditional finance trying to fund that $40+ trillion of accounts receivable. So you have a huge mismatch.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. Wow, that is a big difference.
Yeah, so it's a lot of companies just can't borrow, and there's companies that don't want to borrow. And frankly, if I could be paid earlier, I'd prefer that to being in debt to someone. So I'd rather just get my payments early and not worry about having to go borrow. Or maybe I'm a small company and I can't borrow. Maybe I don't have the relationship with the bank yet, but I've been lucky enough to get this customer. And gosh, it's a great customer, but that customer is paying me in 30 or 45 days, but I need the money tomorrow because I've got payroll next week.
Right.
This is a way for those who either don't want or can't get a banking relationship to be able to be paid versus borrowing. This is a way for those who are borrowing to also be paid sooner, maybe be paid at a rate that's less than what they're paying to their financial institution. Because, again, nothing wrong in the pricing that the financial institution is putting in place, because the financial institution is taking credit risk.
Yeah.
They have to have a price because there's risk. In our market, we can price below that because there is no risk when a large buyer pays their supplier more rapidly.
That's
they're going
right.
to pay them in 45 days anyway, paying them tomorrow at maybe a 5% APR or 4% APR. That's really good for that buyer who's maybe, as I said, making 10 basis points on their cash today, and 3 or 4% APR or 5% APR might be considerably lower than what that supplier, because of the risk equations, having to borrow from a bank.
Right. Yeah, and I guess as an accounts receivable, if I'm asking you to pay me, I'm willing to take that discount. That's my fee then, right? I mean, that's the beauty of it. I'm not really paying anything except the discount.
We don't charge anything for the suppliers on the 1.1 million businesses that don't pay anything to be on the platform, and they get the solution. There's a free product, which is, here's everything that you're going to be paid from your customers over the next course of 30, 40, 50, 90 days. So we'll give them that cash flow forecast. They'll know when they're going to be paid, and they've got the capacity then to go to the next step very easy, you know, one click, and I'll make an offer in the marketplace to accelerate the payment. So lots of folks use us just to be able to plan their cash flow, and then lots of folks, a subset of those, but still a great number of those, use the marketplace to accelerate payment.
Yeah, I love it. I'm just sitting there thinking that this is I don't know why this is so fascinating to me. Maybe it's because I'm not a financial file.
You definitely have a little bit of financial geek in you. I can hear it bubbling.
Maybe.
You're like part of my team. Like, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah.
We can actually do something that's never been done before, and it's a benefit to both sides of this marketplace, both the buyer and the seller. And the way our market operates, the buyer pays us. So as I said, we're not charging the supplier. The buyer pays us our fees, and it's a free solution to use for those 1.1 million businesses on our platform.
Well, I guess maybe the financial geek comes out of me. Again, maybe it's from me from my entrepreneurial side of my business of speaking and coaching and consulting. Man, I love it when I always put in my proposals an option to pay me early at a 10% discount, whatever, some percent discount. I love that instant cash flow. You know, if I can get a client to pay me 12 months up front at a discounted rate, I'm in heaven. You know what I mean?
It's biblical. I mean, a bird in the hand is better than two in the bush.
Absolutely.
It is. I mean, it's primordial in us. We want what we want when we need it.
That's right. When
we should get it. And this just lets you express that appetite, that desire in a marketplace at a price that works for you.
Going back to that kind of question of type you're looking for, I guess more it's a question of the culture. What's exciting to me hearing this, I'm a big fan of businesses when they can define that they're part of, you know, my employees and everybody else and the team that works with me. If I can define and make them feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves, that's a win.
Yep.
And it sounds like you've done that. I mean, you certainly got especially when you've got these numbers, if you've got empirical data that shows that we're changing lives and creating jobs, oh my God. I mean, that has to be a selling feature of the type of people that you attract to come work for you. Am I on target on that?
You're right on and very lucky. I was looking at, someone found an old picture, and this shows you how old it was. It was actually a picture, not something on an iPhone or a digital image. It was an old, you know, printed out picture of our crew. Gosh, I think, you know, in 2000, maybe it was 2012. And I looked at the faces, and maybe there were, I bet there weren't any more than 35 of us back then, maybe less. And I counted, I believe, if I'm remembering, maybe a few faces have left, but I would, without getting precise into the numbers, I think if memory serves, 80% of those people are still with us. So very little turnover, very little turnover in folks who do identify with what we're doing. And as I said, I have a really great team, and as time has passed, right, early on, all of us are sort of the quarterback and the linebacker and the running back all simultaneously, and you're throwing the ball to yourself. That's kind of what it was like early on. And then if you're lucky, you get to be quarterback for a little while, and maybe you get to be a player coach, and then you get to be a coach, and then you get to be a general manager. Our company began to accelerate when we brought in some of the great top management we have today. So we've got Sanjay Gupta, who has been came in as our CMO, moved rapidly to COO, then to president, and has just, you can basically see a 10x in the business from the day he was hired to where we are. You know, well, that's probably more than 10x, but you see a point of inflection from when he came in and what he was able to do. And same thing for Carrie Thurston, who's our CFO. When she came in, that was just the beginning of it's really nice to go back and look at points of inflection and see what the root cause was.
Yeah.
And root cause has been that we've been very lucky to find extraordinary men and women to come into the company who have stayed and provided wonderful leadership that makes it easy for me now to be more of a general manager and really look at the team and say, this is a great team. I want to keep betting on this team. I want to be part of this team.
Hey, we're about halfway through the conversation, but I wanted to take the time to talk about my good friends, the sponsor here of this special series at Equity Bank. Have you ever noticed that most business bankers seem to really understand just one thing? It's banking, right? And not a lot about business. It makes sense since most banks were built generations ago and now they're often run by caretakers, not business builders. Well, it's not the case here at Equity Bank. The bankers at Equity Bank didn't inherit a bank generations ago. They built one of their own. They know that building something takes expertise, vision, and hard work. And over the past decade, they've built one of the region's fastest growing banks by working side by side with customers, with entrepreneurs, with leaders in communities, all throughout Kansas, Missouri, Arkansas, and Oklahoma.
Recently, Equity Bank was listed on the NASDAQ exchange, which gives them even greater capabilities to take on those big deals that growing businesses need to keep on growing. So if you're tired of talking to bankers who've never really ran or owned or built a business, then I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised when you talk to my friends at Equity Bank. Thanks for listening to this show. Let's get back to the conversation, this unique and special series on leadership and entrepreneurship brought to you by my friends at Equity Bank.
I'm wondering how have you always been, I suppose running a bank prior to this, probably the leadership lessons learned from that had to be immense and everything.
Yeah, you know, but it's different. You lead in a different way. I think when I was at the bank, we were pushing 4,000 people, and I think we're plus or minus that number. We've sold some divisions. We've brought in new stuff as well. But this is a more intimate connection.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah.
There was a period of time when I was mistakenly hoping that we could always stay below the Dunbar number and really make this that tribal unit that I wanted. But as we've grown globally, it's been very hard. Dunbar number is 150.
Right.
You may know the reference. But the idea is there's a maximum number of sort of trusted relationships you can have. And the highest order mammal, humans sometimes, max out at about 150, which is sort of why the base unit of military organization, as you well know. What's the base unit? And you are a Marine. Thank you for your service. What's the base unit of military organization? Is it a company or is it a platoon?
Well, it goes all the way down to I would say a platoon is the base. I mean, you go.
How big is a platoon?
Well, a platoon has typically three or four squads. A squad typically has three fire teams of three. So a squad has 9, 10. Let's make it easy. So 30 people. In a platoon,
in a company,
then you got four platoons in a company, so 300 people.
Yeah, four platoons in a company. If you got 30 per platoon, would be 120, right?
Oh, 120. So sorry, yeah.
I've always thought that company is sort of the. It goes back to the Roman legion, companies of men. Of course, they were men at that time, though they might have fought better if they had some more help. But you know, they were 120 to 150 in a company,
right?
And that's interesting to see that. So I'd hope that we could be there. And one of the things I think you're getting to is how do you achieve that when you're, I came into a situation at UMB, lucky enough to be moved up in the organization, even though most of my siblings ended up leaving, not because of me, but moved up in a corporation that already was quite large. So creating a management leadership construct when you're coming into an organization this large, there's a lot of historical precedent that makes it very difficult for you to change culture.
Right.
So in many ways, it's a heck of a lot easier to do it when you start new and start fresh, as long as you keep that culture as your prime focus, getting it right early on, getting the right people who identify with that culture, who understand the ethos and the pathos of our company, and then making sure that they're hiring people of similar ilk. That's the only way I know how to maintain culture, build and maintain culture. I don't know how you do it in a large corporation. Well,
it's like
you haven't had the capacity to historically make it what it was.
Yeah, it's like turning the Titanic. You know, it's like moving a large ship.
Extraordinary people at UMB, and it's one of the best cultures I've ever been in for a large company. But I'll tell you, it was a heck of a lot easier to create and manage and nurture culture in a company that's smaller, which is one of the great joys of being. You know, an entrepreneur is, if you get it right, and oftentimes I don't, but if you get it right and your company begins to succeed, watching that culture grow without your necessarily having to mold it or manage it, but watching it be amplified by those around you, it's one of the really high points when you know you might actually have something that's going to stand the test of time.
I agree. I think that's the exciting part of creating a business. And kudos to you for recognizing it from day one, it sounds like, that the importance of ethos and establishing that culture or planting the seeds of the culture from day one.
Yeah.
It's amazing. A lot of entrepreneurs, I think, and again, I think your business experience and plus your mentors that you've had growing up, I mean, you've had a lot of great examples within your own family that you could have looked up to. I think that probably set a great foundation for you too. I mean,
very, very lucky there.
Yeah.
I was lucky twice, right? Because I was adopted into that family. That was my second adoption. So I got pretty lucky.
I was adopted too.
There you go, brother. That's, I think it does put a little bit of a, I don't say it's a chip on your shoulder, but you always feel like you've got something to prove.
Yeah.
And it always felt to me like, you know, you were, it was never something that was dominant in my mind, but I've known a lot of folks who were adopted that had, they're just, there's a little different way they look at things. There's a little bit different drive. There's a little bit of something that's different. And for me, it's always manifested in wanting to do my own thing, wanting to build, wanting to be successful without a safety net, wanting to show that I could get something done that maybe hadn't been done before, which, by the way, is probably why I left the bank, because I was the fifth generation in my family. So when I retired from the bank, I was not in good standing after that with my father, who was not very pleased that I had retired, but it just was.
Yeah.
It was so important to me to go build something or try to build something that was my own versus something that I had, even though it was a pretty tough career advancement ladder inside the bank. As I said, every one of my siblings before me had been let go at some point in time. It still felt like I was pretty dang lucky to be there, and I wanted to go do something that was
I could see that. I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm like, yeah, I can definitely see that. And I get what you're saying about being for me, being adopted, I always knew it wasn't something. It was never that big of a deal to me in the sense of like, you know, oh, did you always wonder who your real parents were? I felt when I did find out who my birth parents were, I always knew I was adopted as far as I can remember, I guess is my point.
Yeah, me too.
And I think that was huge. And so I always looked at my adoptive parents as my parents, as I'm sure you did.
Absolutely.
But I know what you're talking about when I looked at, there was an undercurrent there. My parents were great, great examples, loving. I couldn't ask for a better childhood. But even when I got around the whole rest of the family, I know when you said there was something to prove, I guess when you said that kind of clicked in me, because I said that was always there, because there was always this kind of the blood gene of the whole, when all the big family got together, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I felt like there was something to prove, and that was probably just me and my
insecurity. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it was in juxtaposition of the family or not. And it's not something that preoccupies my thought nor your thought.
No.
But it's interesting. It's interesting to look at some of the traits that some of my other adopted entrepreneur buddies have, and that they usually have a little, sometimes it can be a chip on their shoulder. Sometimes it can be something to prove. Sometimes it's just a need to go be independent, to go. I haven't really put words to it, but I know there's something there, which is why I didn't know you were adopted. So it's cool to know. Good for you.
Yeah, no, it is cool though. I mean, it resonates with what you're saying. Anyway, didn't mean to dive into our family thing.
Let's put the couch away. We can get off the psychological couch, get back to business.
Right, exactly. But it does go to your mindset though. I was kind of going to, what are your personal habits of success? I mean, what do you do individually to kind of keep yourself on that path? I'm sensing there's something. I mean, it sounds like you've got a little bit of internal discipline. I don't know what it is.
Well, for sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's, I think you do too. Ex-Marines, you've got a hell of a lot of discipline. You probably had it before the Marines, but the Marines further gelled that in you. Mm-hmm. I think you have to have. Now, what's interesting is the different stages that you experience in a company. As I said, we're fortunate to be a growth company. It is a vastly different show now than it was when we were 50 people or 150 people. Now it's more about, now with some of the challenges of the pandemic and the headwinds working from home, you know, I immediately want to sort of run back in and all right, let's get back into hyper management mode. And I've got to now where that's sort of the mindset you have when you're smaller. Now it's more about, hey, step back for a second. Make sure that you're not interfering with the team. First, do you have the right people working on the right problems? If the answer is yes, then your position should be, what can I do to support them? But often, for those of us who have created companies, and I've done a few, your immediate reaction, at least for me, I'm not pointing a finger.
I think it's most entrepreneurs.
I'm going to point the finger at me. My immediate reaction is, da-da-da-da, this is a crisis. I need to get in there and start doing something. And instead of really what that's something that I need to do is say, hey, is this the right team? Do I have the right people? Are they working the right problems? And if all those answers are yes, then back off, ask them what you can do to support them, be there for them, make sure that you're looking at the macros, don't micro, be there for them and be as responsive as you can. Keep in this day where we're diffused now, we're something of an essential business, so I suppose we could have kept operating, but we chose not to sort of be the problem and spread more disease. We said, let's get our folks into the homes and get them safe with their families. But in that period of time, I've spent more time communicating than I ever had. So in some way, all these Zooms that we're doing, I'm actually having more direct conversations, albeit virtually, with more of our team than I have ever had in the history of our company. So if I'm on an all company Zoom and I'm sort of scrolling through, or I'm on the happy hour on Friday evening Zoom and I'm scrolling through and I see some of our folks in India, I can say, well, you know, Priyanka, why are you up at 3 o'clock in the morning attending our happy hour? I hope you have not been drinking since 5 in the afternoon. You know, she's working her butt off, but I've known Priyanka for a while, but then there are other ones, individuals that I've never said hi to. They're looking at me, the camera, I can scroll over, see them and say, hey, you know, Devesh, what's up? And Devesh is like, are you talking to me? Yeah, so tell me what's going on in your world. Those are things that we will continue to do post pandemic, that we should have been doing pre-pandemic, but have been sort of illuminating to me to see the, I feel again, albeit virtually, I feel like I've made more connection with more people one-on-one in the last 8 weeks, 6 weeks than I've had in the last 6 years.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a positive. I mean, you're right. I think for your role where you're at right now, I mean, I think there's nothing more critical, even pandemic or not. I think the role of communicating where the ship is heading and why it's heading that way cannot be understated. I don't think you can over-communicate that, to be quite honest. And
the more complex things get and the more diffuse and the more sort of distraction everyone has, and again, more distraction working from home in many ways, the more important it is, as you said so well early on, to simplify the message.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, we have 100 initiatives going on, and it may feel like 1,000 for the team out there with all the distractions they have. That's all the more reason to put that macro focus on what is it that we're doing. I just had the company meeting. We have a weekly company meeting. I was just talking about this with the team. I said, look, guys, gals, you're doing a ton of stuff. I know you're wicked distracted and you're running hard. Let's remember our job is to get capital to companies so that they can grow. And the way we do that is by making capital convenient and less expensive. And the way we make it convenient and less expensive is get into the marketplace where we're matching all the world's AP with all the world's AR. That's all you have to think about. If you're not doing something that focuses on that, if you're not doing something that takes its derivative value from that, if you're not doing something that relates to that, don't do it.
I love it. I mean, I think that's exactly what you should be doing and maniacally doing it, by the way. Yep. And right. I don't use that word lightly. I think maniacally communicating what you're trying to accomplish. And it's so true. I mean, because of the nature of the beast of who you are and you brought it, this baby from its embryonic stages, you're absolutely right. When the crisis happens, you do want to insert yourself lower in the organization. It's just because it's innate in your personality as an entrepreneur. But to have the discipline to fight, and like you said, a great question, I think, is like, hey, wait a second. Do I have the right people on the bus? Are they in the right seats? Are they doing everything? Okay, scale back. You know, don't insert yourself and dispense the efforts of those of the people that you brought in, right? So I think that's a great...
Well, I'm sure you learned that better than most, and I'm sure the extraordinary amount of combat training you had.
Oh, it was decisions, essential.
Decisions are made at the edges of the network.
Yeah.
Right, where you are. So if you're the general and you're sitting back there trying to make decisions, the fog of war, the delay of information, I was just reading a really great book by Marty Dempsey, I guess No Time for Bystanders. And Marty was making a comment. Of course, he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Making a comment that it was one of his early mistakes was, is, and to be. And he said, sir, I don't know that I've been studying was, is, and to be, because he had just failed in a combat mission, was doing some tank work. And he said, well, you were taking information that was given to you and assuming that it was in present tense and maybe even extrapolating from that into the future tense. Whereas the delay in that communication made it historical. So it was, you right. interpreted it as is, and you made the mistake of thinking that it could be to be. You need to use your intuition, not just to take the data, but to make your own gut feel against that data, that information, understanding that it was historically delayed in getting to you. So you have to have some, you have to have a little bit of, not cynicism, but you have to have a little bit of reality around that to understand that that might not be perfect information. So it is impossible, therefore, for us to make wise decisions in a central, isolated silo away from the edges of the network. So I'm curious, in your Marine training, how did they think about, how do they coach around edge of network decision-making being made by likely less senior leaders, less senior entitled leaders in the military? How did they empower you to act on those decisions without chain of command?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was central to the it's the main reason why the Marine Corps is so successful at what they do, or any small unit leadership like the SEAL teams or everything else. The main reason why they're so successful is because of what you just talked about. I mean, they it's a culture where you're rewarded for asking for forgiveness instead of permission. Now, for that to work effectively, the senior leadership has to be maniacal about communicating what it is they want to accomplish and why. And that has to be completely understood. There has to be clarity and alignment throughout all channels. And that is the rub for the senior leadership and why it makes it so difficult, because that communication is tantamount. Because if you don't have it, then you do have chaos. Let's assuming that it is there, the alignment and the clarity is in place. Well, then everybody's encouraged to push the decision-making to the absolute lowest level possible, the absolute lowest level possible, where the people that have eyes on the opportunity, eyes on the enemy, are empowered to make decisions that support the intent that came down from up high. If the intent is missing, all bets are off. But if the intent is there and you've got the courageous right people on the front lines, eyes on enemy, eyes on customer, whatever you want to call it.
No, you're right. Yep,
they are empowered. And kind of the example I give is like, you know, look at the great hotels and the crappy hotels. And the great hotels empower their frontline desk to pretty much do anything to satisfy that customer. Like, oh, I'm going to comp you a room, or I set you up with our competitor across the street, you know, whatever the case may be, they're empowered to do that. Yep. And the crappy hotels, like, well, my manual says I can only do this. I can only refund you $50 and a gift certificate at Applebee's, you know, or in the bar. You know what I mean? And so, so that's
the hard, and the hard thing is getting intent right.
Absolutely.
Intent simplified, clear, and also, not so much the military, perhaps, because you're dealing with life and death, but the intent can't be something that fails to resonate. Now, obviously, taking that bridge or taking that hill or taking that city.
Well, I need to know why I'm taking that bridge in that city. You know, tell me to take that.
Right. Yeah, fair point. I guess you do. And that's kind of why I'm saying matching all the world's accounts receivable and accounts payable. That's kind of a bland intent. But if you say it's in order to get companies the capital they need to grow, and here's the output of that, 70,000 jobs last year that you helped create.
Bingo.
110,000, 120,000 jobs that you'll get done this year. That's everyone. We talk about matching trillions of dollars. We talk about matching all the world's AP and AR. That's all sort of ethereal, ephemeral numbers. If we say you help create, if there are 500 of us in here and we created 50,000 jobs, then every one of you created 10 jobs, right?
Right. See, that's
100 jobs. Can I get the math right? 50,000, 100 jobs. So that's something I think that resonates.
Absolutely.
But that's still a little bit. If we can tell stories,
absolutely. Yeah.
Here's the supplier saying, "Hey, you know, here's a testimonial. You were able to get me money that I didn't think I could get, so I could then buy inventory to go get this new deal, or I was able to hire this, or I was able to make payroll." Or because of that cash that came in, I'm in a more financially secure position today. Those things are what we celebrate inside our company. We need to do a better job of it. That's something we should be highlighting every day. There should be a daily customer success story. And it should be something that causes you to go, wow, I'm part of a company that did that for Samantha. I'm part of a company that did that for Joe and their company, their business. That's something that's going to make me feel good. I'm going to go home and tell my spouse about it, my kids about it.
You nailed it on the head. I mean, that pretty much defines, and anybody listening to this, that really is the secret sauce and the challenge of what makes, I think, business and leadership so difficult, because you're absolutely right. That, I think, you couldn't set it any more. I couldn't have said it any more better myself. I mean, I think that is the key to why any entrepreneur is going to be successful if they can focus on that. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean it's easy. It's simple to understand. It's not easy.
Distracted, as you were saying, the thousand different things we have to do. It's just, and I get that early on, you might have when you're, look, I remember being at 2 o'clock in the morning, literally on vacation with my wife's family, calling up companies in India who were some of our buyers at that time, who were some of our suppliers at that time, who were supplying little small pharmaceutical companies who were our alpha customers, literally saying, you know, would you like to accelerate $43.79? I'm pitching $43 invoices to multi-billion dollar companies to see if they want to get paid earlier on $43. And the guys are like, who are you and why are you calling? So I was like, oh my God, I might have started something that's not so good. And my wife, you know, my wife's family go, why is your husband up at 2 o'clock? Well, he's got a call. I get it that it's, you know, it's a different environment when you're small like that. The challenge, as you say, is as you grow, simplifying intent.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And making sure that you've got personal stories that resonate with everyone who hears them, whether they're your associates, your board members, your investors, your suppliers, your buyers, pick the stories that have mass resonance and celebrate the hell out of them.
Oh man. I love it. I love what you're saying. Love it. What's next for you? I mean, I could talk to you for hours. I'm looking at the clock. I'm like, oh my God, we got so much. What's next for you? You were talking a little bit before the recording. I love how you think big and again, simplify this with this current. Well, two questions. First of all, how do you feel about the recovery? I mean, it's a roller coaster for me. I don't know if my airline job is going to be on the other side of this. You know, if it is, what is it going to look like? I mean, obviously, all the big major airlines are in precarious positions.
Yeah, they are.
What's next for you guys?
We're sort of motivated by doing things for the underdog. So we're particularly worried about small and mid-sized business, right? So PPP, great program. Absolutely great. Execution's been a little challenged and some sort of moving definitions of what is a qualifying loan, et cetera. But fundamentally, the right direction, and I'm very supportive of it. Now, it's not enough. And one of the things that was choking the banking system and our bank at UMB and you know, the sponsor of this show, Enterprise, also did extraordinary things with PPP to get loans out there. So if you look at a map of the United States and you look at where the most success for PPP was and the amount of relationships and dollars done as a percentage of outstandings, it's the Midwest. Why? Because you have banking relationships there. The coast didn't. So a lot of companies just literally stood in line, didn't have a relationship, didn't get what they wanted. The Midwest and the regional banks and community banks like UMB and Enterprise made all the difference in the world for the entrepreneurs here in the Midwest. We're damn lucky to be here. But it's still not enough. And so our position was there's got to be a way to get dollars to small businesses more effectively than having that small business go to a bank. So, of course, you know what we do in the marketplace. So we immediately looked at the marketplace and said, wait a minute, let's take C2FO out of the equation. Let's just look at the Fortune 1000 companies in the United States. And since we have a fair number of them using the marketplace, let's do some analysis. What does the average Fortune 1000 company have in its supply chain from small and mid-sized businesses? And the answer is, believe it or not, a heck of a lot. The average Fortune 1000 company has 3,000 small and mid-sized business suppliers in its supply chain. And every one of them is owed, on average, call it $450,000 to $500,000. And we're taking this data from our marketplace because we have a lot of these matches already made. Then we said, all right, well, that's super interesting because we might be able to get capital, cash flow to millions of small businesses if we could just cause these 1,000 large businesses to pay them more rapidly. And then we went back and looked at some data around large businesses and said, okay, how come isn't this happening? And it's not because the business doesn't care about small business. They absolutely do. I mean, everybody's very focused on small business right now. A lot of the big companies don't have excess cash. In fact, if you study the big companies, you'll see that they have many times more accounts payable than they have cash on balance sheet. They owe more to the suppliers than they have cash. So they just can't pay everybody because they don't have cash to do it. So our argument was, let's create a fund, tie it to payment to small businesses, but let's have the fund give the money, loan the money to bigger companies with the precondition, the absolute prerequisite, that that money must be immediately used to pay small and mid-sized suppliers in their supply chain. If you do that, we can get $500 to $600 billion of early payment to the nation's small businesses by creating a fund that uses the 1,000 large businesses in our economy to disperse that money. So much more efficient, much more rapid, and it doesn't cause the supplier to have to borrow a penny.
Right. And in theory, hopefully it'll accelerate any type of recovery that we're trying to accomplish.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. We are focused on recovery. I think we've thrown a lot of liquidity at the system, and that liquidity was very necessary. I think there still needs to be more liquidity. Even with that more liquidity, I think we're going to see more insolvency.
I agree. I mean,
as we restart, we're going to have continued business failures, and I don't know how to solve for that other than to look for more creative ways to bring capital to businesses who need it. And that was our thesis. And it's been surprising. Now, things, as you well know, things move slowly in government, but we've had a lot of support for it on the Hill, a lot of support from Treasury, a lot of support from the Fed, and in fact, from the White House.
Well, conceptually, again, it makes perfect sense. I mean, particularly if the 1,000 largest organizations, the bulk of them have more accounts payable and they have cash on hand, that all those suppliers and vendors on the downside of that are just going to suffer. And so if we can do something to free up some of that cash, I mean, again, maybe you can mitigate some of the insolvency. I don't know.
Yeah. What's cool about this is we already have a fair number of, and some I can name, large companies doing this. Walmart, as an example, who is a client of ours inside the marketplace, has created a special fund for small businesses to accelerate capital to them at prices that are almost zero in terms of cost to that supplier. So almost as if it's just free money to the supplier being paid early. So that's an example of a company doing the right thing who also happens to have cash on balance sheet to be able to do it. Now, others don't have as much cash. But as I said, Walmart, Pfizer, Intel are all some of the names I can tell you about that are accelerating today in the marketplace to small and mid-sized businesses at very advantageous rates, because they want to do what they can to keep those small and mid-sized businesses solvent.
Fascinating stuff. Well, I tell you, I've learned a lot in this hour. I feel like
I do too. I appreciate you telling me about the command structure at the Marines. That was highly educational for me.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take and use some of that inside the company.
Yeah. The other side too is what I take that into when I do my consulting and coaching on that is, you know, sometimes I see leaders and they've got 17 direct reports and I go, that's unsustainable. You know, you got to have three or four and that's it. Four max. Right.
I'm looking for no reports. Sign me up. No reports.
Right, no reports.
Here's intent. Go figure out a way to go get it
exactly.
done. That would be perfect.
Yeah. Well, guys, how can people learn more about CTFO and you and connect with you?
I don't think they want to learn anything more about me, but if anybody wants to know more about C2FO, just C2FO.com. And thanks for the time. Really, really appreciate the conversation. Appreciate what you're doing. Thank you for your service and for the military service. And thank you for your service to entrepreneurs doing these podcasts.
Well, and thank you for coming up with this, again, simple idea. Again, the challenges in the execution, but man, it makes perfect sense to me. And it seems like it's helping businesses get more free working capital, which is the name of the game, right? Cash flow is king. And so we've got to, particularly now in this situation. So
yeah,
I appreciate what you're doing. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be with you.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into the show. I hope you got some value out of this episode. If you did, please do me a huge favor. Tell somebody about this show. Tell your spouse, tell your kids, tell your coworkers. Let them know about the value that Dose of Leadership brings to your world. Go to doseofleadership.com. You can learn more about my services. If you're looking for somebody to speak, teach, or coach about leadership, I'm your guy. I'm known for my ability to transform individuals and organizations, teaching them the concept of creating a culture of decentralized leadership. I do think that is the secret sauce to facing all the challenges that we face today. Thanks so much for tuning into the show. I look forward to the next time we're together. And until the meantime, make it a great one.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller. Find your next obsession. Or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.